exciting meeting. I got here as quick as I could and fortunately missed the first half, but I'm looking forward to hearing more. Tough act to follow. That was a really interesting lecture. Sort of the things I'll be doing are, I'll tell you a little bit about biology, but I'll very quickly forget about all biology. This work is part of a big collaboration and centered around my current PhD student who is finishing this summer, Terry Jo, and also a close collaborator, Roberto Camassa. We work closely with the nanoscale physicist Richard Superfine and Leandra Vici, who's basically an engineer, and we also have some strong undergraduate students involved who are very involved in the tabletop experiments we've been doing. Jing Hao is a graduate student of Rich Superfine, who's in nanoscale, working on nanoscale problems. So the basic outline I'll tell you about is sort of motivate the problem from the point of view of study of ciliated tissue. We'll look at some nanoscale microscale experiments that are done where physicists are now moving bodies at very small scales in fluids and looking at the fluid response. Then I'll turn back to the mathematics and try to develop some exact solutions and ask some topic solutions of the equations of fluid motion that actually have a very, very rich structure for this problem. We will look at our own experiment that we did to try to validate this theory and return to the microscale. That's the basic plan. So motivation is driven by work at UNC on understanding the role of cilia in the lung and how cilia affect transport of mucus. Here is an image of cilia. It's a field of cilia, very densely compact, many cilia per unit area. And the typical scale of a cilia is about 200 nanometers in diameter by 5 to 10 microns in length, and they beat on the order of 10 hertz. There's another system called the node that happens in developing fetuses, where early in development a depression forms and small cilia sprout, and these are called primary cilia to be distinguished from the cilia in the lung. And they're different in two ways. They're much more dilute than in the case of what's coating the surface area tissue of the lung, and also they're rigid. And instead of beating like our usual concept of how cilia acts, these tend to rotate. And these are very interesting. It's been shown that they have a lot to do with the developing asymmetries in a body. If you somehow genetically mutate the organism so that these hairs don't grow, subsequently the heart can form on the wrong side of the body. You can have there's believed to be a connection between these problems with these cilia and a syndrome called Cartagener syndrome, which is somewhat rare disorder where people are infertile and they have chronic cough and the like, and their cilia don't work properly in the lung also. So there's a lot of motivation for this from biology. We're going to basically be looking at this problem today mathematically and experimentally. The tool that the physicists have used is the ability to fabricate similar structures on small scales of approximately 10 microns in length by 200 nanometers in cross-sectional diameter that are made of soft magnetic materials that they can control and move around with the exposure of external magnetic fields that are time varying. So here is actually some images of cilia of the first type this is a cell culture coating the surface of the lung. This actually is a cell culture grown in their laboratory. And I have to click it a few times to make it work. There it goes. This is a side view showing the typical motion of cilia in the lung. A top view gives you some similar perspective of what we've seen before, this type of sort of beating motion with a power stroke and a return stroke. Ultimately, I think that the nanoscale physicists are interested in being able to do actuation where they have synthetic materials in the fluid that they can control with external magnetic fields, but that's a long ways off. What can be done right now is something where, hold on a sec, they have a device that's called a magnetic force microscope, which was designed in at the University of North Carolina. It's an array of electromagnets, independent electromagnets, which clamp down on a slide. And by adjusting the currents independently in these six coils, you can focus a magnetic field into a small, approximately 100 micron cube test section and vary those dynamically, those magnetic field strengths. What that allows them is to...
What is the field strength?
It's pretty strong. I don't know exactly how strong it is in terms of Tesla. I don't know.
Well, how about Gauss?
I don't know that either.
Okay.
I don't have that information. It's pretty strong, I'd say. So the types of experiments they're interested in doing are seeing if they can get these small-scale rods to do interesting things. So what they actually you'll see here, this is going to be a nanoscale rod. This is a visual image. This is bright field. And so technically it's blurred because it's supposed to be 200 nanometers in cross-section by approximately 5 to 10 microns in length. You're going to see it precess under the motion of these, under the imposition of this external field. This is a 1 micron non-magnetic polystyrene sphere that will precess around it, and that's the motion I'm interested in exploring here. So I'll just play it for the moment that we can watch it. So the motion of the sphere, so this is in a fluid. Typically you have two slides and they inject with a syringe beads in these rods that somehow the rods tend to like align with the magnetic field lines, and they're pulled downwards, and they frictionally attach to the base, and they process like this.
Is the motion in the wrong direction? I mean, is the motion in the same direction as the rod is rotating?
Yes, it is.
It is, yeah. It looks like it's wrong. Okay.
It's, there is some aliasing. This is approximately 10 hertz, and it's filmed at 30 frames a second. But it is moving in the same direction. So the motion of the sphere is actually composed of sort of two motions, a slow orbit and a motion which is sort of jitter back and forth, which is actually an epicycle motion that is commensurate or roughly proportional to the rod rotation rate. Actually, it's very interesting exactly what's happening with this system. I should also say on these scales, if we extinguish this motion, you would see quite a bit of Brownian fluctuation on these scales. And it's a very interesting problem to understand how coherent energy coherent motion that's put in from large-scale magnetic fields, you'll have a fluctuating hydrodynamic system that's both fluctuating because it's coherent energy that you're injecting from large-scale, but also from thermal component of the small-scale fluid system. And I will not talk a lot about the thermal fluctuations in this lecture. So if you, let's see if this will come up. So here's actually a track that shows sort of what the motion is, and it's going to basically sweep out a slow orbit, and it'll come pretty much back to the same place if we watch it for a long time.
Why does the rod stay in the same place? Is it tethered in some way?
It's not tethered. It in this particular experiment, it is just frictionally it's frictionally attached to the surface. There's no substrate or anything that it's locked into. It's just simply friction on the glass that's holding it in place. So lots of interesting questions about this from a modeling perspective. You technically speaking, these things are synthetic, but they come out with statistics. We don't actually know how big they are. We don't especially know how wide they are, what their diameter truly is. To actually measure that, you have to pull them out of the experiment or take them in a sample and put it into an electron microscope, and you'll get a statistical distribution, which is around 200 nanometers in cross-section. Once these are put into the fluid, of course, they rust, they change their geometry, they thicken, and it's you can't view with optics on these scales. Moreover, you cannot see any kind of three-dimensional behavior which might be present in this system in the form of vertical motion up or down, or even knowing exactly what the height of this trajectory is difficult. And it's especially difficult. There are microscopic systems where you can get different projections, but in this particular apparatus, the magnetic system which surrounds the slide makes it very difficult to get other fields of view in the experiment. So
do you need the top glass plate? Actually, you don't need that, do you?
No, you can leave it opened. They tend to leave it closed. It's approximately 100 microns thick.
Yeah.
That would change the boundary condition on the fluid.
Yeah, exactly.
So
that would be
interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
We tend to presume, as you'll see, that it's an infinitely deep fluid. And
is
it does pretty well, but.
Is there an optimal distance or distance that's minimum energy distance that's obtained by the particle for a given beat frequency? Because that particle started further out.
Yeah.
And it seems to have migrated to a circle.
Yeah.
Maybe it's an equal diameter from the center.
Yeah.
And if you keep watching it, will it stay at that distance from?
It goes all over the place. It goes back out. It goes out of focus. Actually, it drops out of the plane.
Okay.
So we believe, that's one possible explanation is there's a thermal fluctuation on top of this coherent system, which is pushing it in and out, up and down. The hydrodynamics, as we'll show, if you have an idealized motion of a simple rotary rod, we can show mathematically that it should not move inward or outward. It takes something else to create that, such as an asymmetry that you might induce by changing the shape of the rod or having the rod tilted, things like this. So that's some of the punchlines of the mathematical analysis that we'll do. So another thing, this is why I was asking John you about this in your lecture. The way they get these rods into the system is they take a syringe and they inject them. And, then they watch the microscope, these things come in and they align. Sometimes they get stuck, and they need to pull them across. So they'll actually put a little piece of paper towel on one end, and that creates a large-scale fluid flow, which if you take a look at this, you can see this thing almost looks alive in some ways. There's a rod that's spinning here. You're going to see these beads that come flying across. They're at higher altitudes. And they're essentially unaffected by the rod, but some will actually come in and get trapped in this motion, stay for a while, and then exit and leave. So that's a fairly interesting mathematical problem to understand exactly how that's happening. But that was what there was. I was curious if you had a large-scale flow that was unrelated to the motion of the cell. So.
Well, we can do that, and it's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because the cells relate to that flow. Like this thing, they may send off a radio.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't get to that part of the talk, but it does happen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we make it happen.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. We're going to set our experiment up so that doesn't happen. We're going to study it in the neutral state at rest, except for Brownian fluctuations. So I want to just basically discuss briefly what the mathematics of this problem are. So if we assume the continuum approximation is correct, which it will eventually fail on sufficiently small scales, but on these scales it seems to be reasonable. You have the Navier-Stokes equations, the nonlinear partial differential equations that govern the motion. If you non-dimensionalize these equations, you identify two groups, the Reynolds number and the Struhal number, which relate to how fast the rod is spinning and the length of the rod and the viscosity of the fluid. At low Reynolds number, and if the Reynolds number is small and the Struhal number is not large, you can neglect this inertial term and just study this system here, which is the Stokes equations, much simpler than the Navier-Stokes equations. It's worth a remark that if you work in turbulence, you have to deal with these nonlinearities, but your interaction lengths are typically smaller than at small scales. So you have small length scales, very large, long-range interactions, hydrodynamic interactions. Fortunately, the system becomes linear on small scales, which can very much help us in the analysis. So I want to give a little bit of an introduction to how you handle solving these equations with solid mathematical and asymptotic analysis. So the fundamental building block, just as in potential theory, is to come up with the Green's function for this system. The basic Green's function for the Stokes equation is called the Stokeslet, where basically you put an impulse, a unit impulse of momentum into the equations, and you ask how the system responds. So it's an impulse of momentum.
This problem can be solved in free space in closed form, which gives you this Stokeslet solution and pressure distribution that is used from this. We can build many, many solutions of the fluid equations. So this is the building block that we start with. And so this, just like in potential theory or electrostatics, you have sort of your Green's function, and then all of the higher multipoles are the derivatives of the Green's function. Same deals here. It's a little bit more complicated because this isn't a second-order problem. It's more of a fourth-order problem. Okay. Good reference for this is Pazurkiewicz's book. So how do you utilize singularities in practice to solve boundary value problems? What you do, perhaps you have a volume that you are interested in asking what is the flow field that is induced. If you have a uniform translation, for example, you have some fluid flow in space, and you say, well, what would happen if I drop a rod into that fluid flow? Well, it's going to affect the fluid flow locally. How do you compute that local disturbance? One way is to assume you can introduce inside the body singularities of the Stokeslet kind, or perhaps more elaborate derivatives of Stokeslet and the like, inside the body in such a way that on the body, we're supposed to have no slip condition. So you have fluid flow coming into the body, it's going to be non-zero there, so you have to create inside the body a set of singularities that modifies the fluid flow on the boundary. And the way that distribution of interior singularities is selected in such a way that you somehow magically get to cancel the fluid flow that comes in from infinity on the boundary, and then that those distributions will then give rise to a disturbance. And it is in this way that you would, if you could do this exactly, you would have an exact mathematical solution of the Stokes equations. Okay? Yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I would just like to say that for those of you who were in my lecture who saw these gorgeous field lines around certain microorganisms, that's exactly how they were obtained. So just giving
a little kind of introduction to this. So the mathematical problem of how you choose a singularity strengths is really the question that we're interested in. And so actually this Gray and Hancock quite a while ago examined this problem. And so what you'll get ultimately is an integral equation. So if you look at what the contribution of these interior Stokeslet would be, you put these singularities inside the boundary, and you ask what is their strength on the boundary. The idea is that strength is supposed to cancel whatever fluid flow is embedded, that you've embedded your body in precisely. So we look at what the Stokeslet contribution would be. If we just had Stokeslets inside the body, you would have these three integrals for the different components of the velocity, U1, U2, U3. Of course, that's supposed to be selected so that it cancels the far field boundary condition coming into the body. So in general, that's a messy integral equation. It's not clear you can solve it. So the idea of slender body theory is to assume that this fluid flow is an integral, and it's subsequently going to be evaluated on the boundary. If you look at that in the asymptotic, lets you evaluate these integrals exactly, if you could do that, which you can often, you could ask, well, what happens to the contribution what an integral like this when you evaluate on the boundary of the body, right? Because it's going to depend upon the spatial location of the fluid. So when you do that, in general, you get a mess. But if you look at the asymptotic setup, where the ratio of the length of the body, the ratio of the cross-section of the body to the length of the body is small, then you can apply elementary asymptotic analysis to compute the asymptotic expansion of these integrals in small cross-sectional radius. And so that what that basically does is turns this integral equation into elementary algebra. It's a straightforward calculation. There's not much to it. So Batchelor did a nice study of this in JFM, where he sort of looked at what Gray and Hancock did, was to embed the body in a constant fluid flow. What if you change that to a fluid flow which has structure, has linear structure? And Batchelor showed how you account for that in a precise way.
I'm sorry, what is delta?
Delta is the ratio of the width of the body to the length of the body.
So R naught is where it
ends. Yes. Yeah.
So the top equations are
Yes, these are like single layer type. You can do much more fancy things than this, and we're just doing the simplest thing just to show how it works here. So if you do that expansion, you find how to cancel. This is the asymptotic expansion of the Stokeslet's contribution on the boundary. And now the question is, how do you choose these unknown strengths to cancel the incoming velocity field? Well, it's algebra. It's trivial algebra. You just solve one equation at a time, right? It's a lot easier than solving an integral equation. So when you do that, you find that the strengths are chosen in this well-known 2-to-1 ratio, depending upon whether the fluid is coming this way or coming transverse to the body. Okay? Well, you could ask, could I do that? How well does this do in practice? And I will tell you at the end of this lecture, it does absolutely fantastic if you use images. But you might ask, could I actually build a solution which exactly matches the boundary condition via the same principles? And so, in other words, if I have a true body, could I distribute an array of singularities inside of the body so that I don't just asymptotically satisfy this integral equation, but I do it analytically. So an example is the case where it's difficult to do this in practice general, but if you have the case of an ellipsoid, you can find a way to do this. And in fact, it dates back quite a while to Edwardes in 1892, and he didn't use singularity methods. He just directly solved the problem by working in a sphere in elliptical coordinates. But more recently, Wu and Chuang in the 70s, showed how to redo this calculation by distributing singularities inside the body. And that you can exactly, so for example, if you have a motion of an ellipsoid that is like this, you can select the distribution of singularities inside the body so that you exactly satisfy the boundary conditions. And that is listed here. It involves more elaborate singularities than just the Stokeslet. It involves stresslets and rotlets. Potential dipoles, and so I list them here. They're a mess, but just keep in mind it can be done. You can check the algebra, and it does work. So for the particular problem in hand, technically speaking, we want to do this type of motion to develop a solution. That has a flat plane wall, thinking about the microscopic experiment. Let me first try to do that with a motion that's sweeping out a double cone like the following. So I have to somehow generalize what was done for the case of by Chuang, and well, actually Edwardes did motion, rotary motion about any axis. So you can ask, how do I turn that into a solution that's more involved than that? And that's actually somewhat complicated. So the strategy we use is to basically start with something like this and apply a steady rotation through something like this that modifies the boundary condition at infinity, and then try to satisfy that boundary value problem through similar singularity methods, and you can do it. And so I call this the generator. Basically, the far field, we assume we have a linear matrix, and from applying those rotations on the last slide, you get that the form of the matrix A has this particular structure, and the idea is you have to select your singularity strengths so that you cancel on the boundary this linear fluid flow. It's involved. Can be done. So let me show you what happens. Okay, this is what does the particle trajectories look like for this exact mathematical fluid flow? So comment on this. At this, so I have an exact solution of the 3D Stokes equations. They will be time varying, a three-dimensional time varying system. I in general would not be able to solve that exactly. So we perform highly accurate simulations of that ODE system. But this is extremely controlled. And here is what the solution looks like for three sample trajectories in one particular ellipse. So we're going to slowly pan so that you get a view of what the fluid motion, what the particle motion, Lagrangian coordinates look like under this evolution. So it is just like the experiment, consists of a fast epicycle and a slow orbit. And viewed from the side, has this distribution, and from the top looks like that. In general, the coordinates are very complicated. The trajectories are three-dimensional, and the motion is quite interesting. So this sort of thing that if you were a nanoscale experimentalist, you might think about is that you're in you're looking through a microscope, you've got this actuation that you've set up, you see a trajectory, it's doing something, okay? A lot of missing information in that experiment, such as how big is the object, et cetera. If you had a map that explained to you how big a fluctuation you should see as a function of where you are in the spatial domain, that would probably be useful information. As far as, you know, you could figure out, well, do I have the right amount of, assuming you could do the hydrodynamics exactly, then that would be a useful tool. So let me see. So before showing you that, here's some other renditions of the line of particles. So this is, you know, what I like about this is analytic. It really doesn't require any CFD, and it looks very fluid. That's another thing I like about it. I can't show it again right now, but it definitely has the appeal of a fluid system, a viscous fluid system. Here it is again. I think it's great. I'm really, really happy with this.
So if you want your back, it goes exactly the same.
It sure does, yeah. Numerically, I can do that. Yes.
Is the ellipsoid as stiff as it rotates, or does it rotate as it rotates?
This is an excellent question. So, you can build in addition to this an arbitrary rotation. You can do that exactly also.
Yes.
And it's a mess, but you can do it, and you can process what happens to the particle trajectories. And I'll show it in just a minute.
Great.
Okay. In practice, no nanoscale scientist should be able to tell you the answer to that question experimentally, because it's just too hard to visualize. But
well, you could always put a little light on it.
Right. So anyway, the guys I work with, I ask them this question, they're like, I don't know. But so in a moment I'll tell you about these. We redid the experiment on a table, and it depends, the independent rotation about the body is very much dependent upon the frictional contact. Yeah. And it's all over the place. In slender body theory, that effect is subdominant to the large-scale rotation. It doesn't show up at leading order. You have to have a thick body to see any effect of that on Lagrangian trajectories. So that maybe makes it okay in practice. So here is this fluctuation amplitude map. So let me tell you what this is. This is viewed from the side, varying the cone geometry from fatter to thinner bodies, and varying. This is an angle of the cone angle is 30 degrees, and here is 60 degrees. The thing to note about this, what we're plotting is, we're looking from the top, and we're looking at the polar projection of the epicycle as it goes around, and we're asking how big is that amplitude of that motion as a function of where you are initially, viewed from the side. So you can imagine that. A dozen statistics you could look at for this kind of dynamical system. So here's what it looks like. So just below the cone height is a sweet spot, just on the inside of the body. And if you look at it in process trajectories, this is the kind of map you have, very asymmetric, which is unusual. And so you might ask, well, it seems like if I started here and just waited a half rotation, I would have been in the same place here. And so how is that possible? So it's the system is non-autonomous. So if you process the Poincaré section on integer times, you can ask, if I start a tracer here, where does that tracer interval intersect that same plane on the other side on integer times? And you will draw out, there's a mapping from this circle to this banana that's present in this fluid system. Pretty interesting. So additional spin, John was asking. Here it is. Here's, if you let the... As it rotates, you let there be a rotation that is twice the value of the rotation. This way, for this example, here's what happens to the particle trajectories. They actually sweep up and down the body depending upon where you are. Of course, it goes away if I make it slender. That effect is, I mean, it makes sense. You're not putting very much torque in the fluid if it's slender. So, but yes.
This doesn't match the actual particle trajectory that you show, not exactly.
That's a good point.
If you introduce the Ozane correction, does that help?
No, not in this system. We're really low Reynolds numbers. In that experiment, it's about 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 5. So we're not to the point where Ozane is going to help us. Ozane will help eventually, I think that what's really confounding that, and I'll show you the tabletop, which it's right on the money. It's right on the money. The small scale's got these fluctuations that's where the thing is very different. The thermal Brownian motions are just changing the story a lot, and that's interesting.
If the rotating particle were way out there, then you would have to use the same motions, right? Because they're really far away.
I suppose that's true, but you wouldn't see very much. It'd just be sitting there. So if you run it for a long time, that's true. If you drag a ball in a fluid, there's all kinds of problems with the OC far away, with the Stokes far away. Yeah, that's true. Yes.
But instead of specifying the motion, shouldn't you just write down the magnetic forces on it and solve the rigid body dynamics for the
coupled to the fluid mechanics? You could do that. You could. That would be. What would be different about that?
Well, that would determine, what rotation there is.
Well, almost,
area.
Except for there's a frictional force that requires some modeling at the base, and that's pretty complicated. Exactly how the thing's kind of rolling around, right? And it's actually there's a considerable amount of uncertainty with any kind of frictional modeling. That's actually so. In our tabletop experiment, if we stick it in to a piece of paper, the spinning is very different than if we just set it on the glass table. So depending upon the form, but I agree with you. The doubly coupled system of the electromagnetic or the magnetic system coupled to the hydrodynamic system, that would be really good to solve. And we have not done that. And I suspect it could be done, but we haven't done that. So that's a great suggestion, but we haven't done it yet.
What's the Ozean correction?
So the Ozean correction is to basically correct for an inertial term. So we dumped inertia in the Stokes equations. If you want to correct for that, make a correction to that drop in the term of the nonlinear term, you can do that systematically by retaining a little bit of that. And there's a matching way of doing it so that you figure out how to incorporate that. That's the correction. You keep a little bit of the nonlinearity and process it. Gives you corrections to the drag law that depend upon the Reynolds number.
Yeah, but there's the Ozean paradox.
Yes, that's there's all kinds of problems with systematically correcting for inertia. That's very true. That's yes.
You could stick a sphere on the bottom of the rod and hold the sphere in an optical trap, and then you'd have no friction. And then you could put a little leg on the sphere and
play all these sorts of
things. It'd
be wonderful. It'd be wonderful. To see something interesting, you have to have sort of a thick body. That's one thing I do feel confident. Because if I make this slender, so lots of 3D motion in this system, lots of it. If I make the body more and more slender, it goes away. So it's fairly idealized for several reasons. One is that this thing is actually sweeping not a single cone, but a double cone. So how do you correct for that? So mathematically, it's difficult to do exactly. But you can appeal to slender body theory and try to use images. So John Blake developed what the Blake slit, which is if you drop a Stokes slit in an upper half plane above a flat infinite plane, no slip plane, you can ask what kind of images do you have to distribute below to cause there to be no fluid flow on this flat plane. And there are three that you have to write down. We've summarized them here. So you have to have an image Stokes slit and an image stresslet. There's a few other terms you have to add for it. And the count makes sense. You want to, the stokeslet causes there to be vertical flow, so image Stokes, it kills that vertical flow. But then to have no horizontal flow, you're going to need a couple other singularities. So he worked that out. So we drop them on a line and verify that you can asymptotically spin them. And so this is kind of interesting to compare the motion. Of course, in the right place, we've drawn a spheroid, but it's kind of really just fictitious, where on the left it's the exact solution, the exact body. And you can see the difference in the trajectory properties. The Blake slit looks at near the tip much more has much more large vertical motion. That's kind of interesting. So how does this stuff do compared to experiments? So that's what I want to get to next. So what we did, so we started trying to utilize these measurement, these theory to compare to the microscale experiments, the nanoscale measurements, and we had a lot of trouble. We got it working as good as we could as far as matching amplitude as a function of where you are, and but we had a lot of trouble. So what we decided to do is to redo the experiment scaled up by 3 or 4 or 5 orders of magnitude to a table. So what we did was we have a beaker. We wish to have the same Reynolds and Struhal number, and so you can't use water or you'll have to wait forever to see anything. So we switched to corn syrup, matched the Reynolds and the Struhal number. Now we're moving, instead of at 10 hertz, we're spinning on the order of about 3 or 4 revolutions per minute. And then what you do is, the way you actuate this system is, instead of using these external magnetics, we put a stereo magnet below the beaker, put it on a motor, and move it in a circle. It has the same basic effect. So here's what it looks like. In the tabletop, you got all kinds of extra information, like you have better cameras you can draw, you get infinite resolution compared to the nanoscale, and you also have side views. So my camera that I used for this wasn't so good on the side view, but you get a feeling of what's going on. It kind of jitters a little bit. But basically, we have a line of bubbles that we put into the fluid. Of course, they're a little bit light. They tend to rise a little bit. But they exhibit a dance around the body up and down in forward time. So what's more interesting is to look at it from the top.
Where was the body there? The body was... Sorry.
So the body is... there's a flat wall here. It's tied right here. It's spinning around like this. It's the side view. Okay, so
what's the thing on the bottom?
That's actually a reflection.
Oh, that's a reflection.
Yeah,
okay.
And we use that actually to align it. It's actually a great alignment technique.
Yeah.
So now from the top, very interesting. So I was looking from the side, was looking up this way. Now I'm looking from the top so that I've got a line of bubbles. The camera's rotated a little bit. But it's going to be interesting to see how this line of bubbles moves under the influence of this fluid motion, this actuated fluid motion. And you can see they do a very similar behavior as, it's definitely distinct from the small scale because it has less thermal fluctuation. But that was the goal of this. Let's make sure the theory is correct on the large scale. So let me show you what the traces look like tracking one of these beads. It makes an extraordinarily nice epicycle if you dynamically track it in time. It starts here, slowly migrates around the body. Essentially circular. It's not perfect. There's a little, the bubble's rising a little bit. It starts at about the cone height, so you'd expect the amplitude of fluctuation to decay as you move upwards. It does, but it's pretty good. And moreover, if you look at, there's a bunch of bubbles there. If you track them, you can make a comparison. I think this is interesting. So the orange is the experimental data tracked. These things are going this direction, this direction, this direction. You see, as you get closer to the body, you have a larger amplitude of fluctuation. The free space solution is in green, and the blue is the Blakeslet solution. And the Blakeslet is just dead on the money. It tracks the tracer very, very well. So there are no adjustable parameters in this. We just look at measure the pin, put it down, see what the angle is, boom, let it go. It's dead on. The free space tends to travel in theta too far. And so that's the effect. The amplitudes are about right for the free space, but the overall angular velocity isn't quite right. So in my opinion, this is doing extremely well. I think that we have a very solid theory. The quasi-steady Stokes approximation from a very controlled set of experiments that we did where we have no thermal fluctuation is really doing a good job. You can do some other things. This is another effect that I don't have a great explanation for it at the moment, except to say Faxon correction. So what we have here is the same. We've switched to oil. It's still low Reynolds number motion. Though the Ozine correction might play more of a role in this, because the viscosity isn't as big as the Caro, so we're actually at a slightly higher Reynolds number than before. What we have is a glass bead, neutrally buoyant, and the oil, and a bubble, a single air bubble, that's not neutrally buoyant, but resides over the timescales of this experiment at approximately the same altitude as this. They are initially the same distance from the distance from where the rod is pinned to here is the same as this distance, approximately. So the question would be, who's going to win the race as I start actuating this, spinning this rod? And I wouldn't have any idea, but interesting question, right? In other words, you know that the thing's going to, when they start spinning, it's going to push this around. It's going to push this around. So.
Well, since you asked the question, it's going to be the bubble.
It's going to be the bubble. That's great. That's probably what I would have thought, because it got this big bead. How's this thing going to push this big? But it's actually just the opposite.
No,
so
I thought because the bubble is so far away, and you think it would go so, never mind.
Well, actually, that's part of the truth of this is that this thing's pretty close, so it's feeling more fluid flows.
Yeah, yeah.
But let me play it, and you can just watch what happens. The bubble, the glass bead actually catches up with the bubble and passes underneath it. The bubble, if you watch from the side, as this thing comes around, it gets pushed up and over and comes back around. So, that's a wonderful question. It must. But we haven't labeled it in a way to tell, but it sure should rotate, absolutely. So here it comes. It's going to catch up. So I like these types of measurements because they don't have any biology in them. I'm not ready to think about the biological questions, but they're you know, should have a handle on the mathematics and the physics experiments, I think, at the same time as the biofluids.
You should see the bacteria moving big bubbles around.
Really?
They attach and they move, they push them.
See, I didn't want to think about that. let's see. So, other things, somebody asked about reversibility in the mathematics, yes. In the experiment, pretty much yes. So what we've set up here is two loops of dye that will be pushed around by this rod. I can show it here. And you can see that the, so again, I apologize, we didn't have the frame rate great, but it's going to...
Is this one rod or two rods?
It's one rod. That's a shadow on the bottom. And now it's unwinding the other direction, and it will pretty much bring back the initial shape, sort of classic GI Taylor, but for a little tailored to this, we're doing this. So, and from the side, very nice from the side. This, I think, is really, really very pretty. And you can see how the dye loops get stretched, and then reversing time, how they nearly reconstitute their shapes. I should... Yes?
The needle in the G.I. Taylor experiment is not reversible. And so you have some fluid that should be reversible together with the needle, which isn't it.
Uh-huh. Oh, the needle. You mean when he puts the needle?
Yeah,
yeah, sure, sure, right. Sure. So I think in this particular case, if I discounted the diffusion of dye and the fact it was another fluid motion, that I should be able to reverse it exactly. Because of the rates I'm spinning at. If I increase the rates a little bit, no. If I put in a, like you said, a solid, rigid body, no.
Yeah. Actually, what I just said was nonsense, because the needle in his experiment goes on different streamlines, and that's what's done.
That's right, right.
What's the total time?
Oh, this is spinning at about, this one's about 10 revolutions per minute, and this is in Caro, and we probably ran it 30, 40 revolutions. Total, maybe 25 revolutions forward time, 25 revolutions backwards time.
I'm trying to figure in the effect of diffusion of the dye.
Oh. Haven't thought about that. I don't know the diffusion constant. But yeah, that's probably a good thing to think about. Yeah, we haven't looked at that. In all of this, I've worked in advection diffusion for years, but in this particular set of work, we are neglecting, you know, in developing this mathematical solution, we've neglected the thermal diffusion in the tracers, and it's not clear to me exactly how it should be modeled. You could have a Langevin term, just add additive noise to the particle trajectories, or maybe you should do something more elaborate to the basic hydrodynamics. So we'll go back to small scales now and see. Just I'll report what we are able to do with Blakeslip. In the best now, here we got lots of tuning. because on the tabletop I know everything. I know exactly what the size of the body is and exactly the angle. I can see things from all sides and get very accurate measurements of the XYZ location of the particle trajectories. On the small scale, down in the nanoscale for these spinning rods, on very small scales, we don't have that kind of information. So we do the best we can with this Stokes model. That is to say, we adjust for the size of the body, the cone angle, allow for a little bit of fluctuation in the vertical to try to catch this sweet spot, to basically get the data, which is the epicycle amplitude as a function of radius, to match the experimental data. We do a pretty good job in the near field, although my colleagues in physics are not so happy with the parameters that we have to use. They would prefer us to use smaller, they're nanoscientists, so they very important that they have nanoscale objects. And when we first did the fitting, the best we could do was use a 1 micron cross-section rod to do the fitting. We tweaked it around, and by finding that sweet spot, we were able to fit the data. This is radius as a function of basically a statistic that measures how big the epicycle amplitude is as a function of where you are. So we can do a pretty good job in the near field, but at the far field, we don't do so good. This is the thermal floor. This is the size of the energy in this particular statistic has. There's going to be thermal noise at some scale, so it's going to saturate the model. So you shouldn't expect things to agree here, but out here it should be better than this. So the question is, what is the origin of this mismatch? So there are several different answers, and I can only tell you a few of them. One is, it's been suggested that outside of the field of view of the microscope is yet another rod that's over here spinning. Could well be the case, but they haven't really shown us the measurements for that. Another is the possibility that the rods aren't really straight, and they're somehow bending the rods has the effect of there being a longer range interaction than we presently understand. That's possible. We're not going to know that. So we've been doing measurements on the tabletop with bent rods, trying to see what happens. And so there's the hope we'll understand that that set of comparisons. And preliminary information seems to suggest that, yes, the effect of bending can actually increase the fall-off rate of these epicycle amplitudes as a function of distance. But that's fairly preliminary. And yes, John.
Where the thing starts going off, is that commensurate with the height of the layer?
No. I mean, the layer is it's a good question. This is the layer is supposed to be 100 microns deep. This is supposed to be 2.5 body lengths.
Oh.
So we're about 20. So it could be. I mean, I can't, but I'm only over 20 microns high right here.
Well, by taking the top off, you can see if that goes down.
So, I'm sorry, I didn't even say that quite right. The rod is like this. I've got, 100 microns of difference distance to the top. The rod height is about 10 microns. I'm moving to a place where I'm moving along a line here that's approximately 25 microns away. Where it starts to depart from the behavior. So that's the situation. And so you're wondering, could the surface be playing a role?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't know. Could be. Could be another possible explanation. Another possible explanation which is, let me just say it. Perhaps there is some kind of interaction with the thermal fluctuations and the coherence induced by the large scale magnetic forcing that is doing something different to the system. I said it. Maybe that's blasphemy, I don't know. But we're at the stage in technological advances where people can actually begin to revisit many of those assumptions about how thermal is interacting with hydrodynamics on these smaller scales, where you can really do solid measurements, well, pretty solid measurements, maybe not as good as you can on a controlled tabletop. But remember, this is pretty remarkable that these guys are able to do this kind of motion, spin a rod. We were involved with trying to help them figure out how to do that. So they came to us and said, we want to wanted to spin a circle, an upright, here are the, we have these six coils of wire. Can you tell us what, you know, what current, what, how we should drive these wires as a function of time to do that? So we went away and worked on that and came back with an answer that didn't work. But by that time, they figured out how to just turn the knob so that it did work. So you know. But anyhow, you know, it's very complicated. You can imagine just, you know, how this thing actually works in practice. So with that, I'll just stop and say a few things about what we're doing with this. We're pretty far from modeling the interaction of cilia on the lung, but we do have pretty solid mathematical confirmation of the validity of the quasi-steady Stokes approximation, at least on tabletop scales. Things work pretty good, but there's some unresolved issues there on the smaller scales down on the nanoscale. I feel pretty confident in saying that I think that doing the mathematical hydrodynamics really carefully, having solid results, can help interpret small-scale measurements where you have a lot of missing information. But it shouldn't be over, you know. We want to remember that the hydrodynamics is also not correct on the small scales. You get down to these really small length scales, and the question of the validity of the continuum comes into play. The validity of what's happening with thermal fluctuations becomes an issue. So anyway, some of the things we're doing now trying to generalize this is to retain the time derivative, not the Ossian term, but the actual time derivative in the Stokes equation. So we retain linearity, but we're not trying to get the inertial terms yet, except for a linear time derivative. And again, I alluded to, I'm missing a parenthesis, sorry, this alluded to bent rods, multiple rods. You can imagine doing this for many rods as long as they're dilute. This is something you could do. And lastly, in the lung, the mucus in the lung is known to be strongly non-Newtonian. So Isaac Clapper is an expert on this type of stuff. And I don't know if you'll tell us anything about that in your lecture, but we haven't looked at that. But this summer we're planning to redo our experiments by adding starch and the like into our fluids to see how can we develop theories that, so there should be a generalization of Blake's theory that will work.